Today, we're talking good and bad products in the high cash value life insurance space. We're going to talk whole life. We're going to talk IUL. Welcome to the Life Insurance Financial Education Podcast. We're pulling back the curtain on high cash value life insurance and how it can help you build wealth and achieve your financial goals. My name is James Barber. I'm your Oregon Cash Flow Pro.
And my name is Carlo Vaquera with NetWealth Finance.
Pleasure to have you with us this week. Carlo, there's a lot of products out there in the high cash value life insurance space. I think we start whole life and then we'll move on to IULs. What do you look for in a whole life product when you're designing a high cash value product? I guess, what's the number one thing you might look for?
So the absolute number one thing is the dividend rate and its crediting history. I think that's the main thing when we're looking at a whole life carrier. How much have they paid in a dividend for how long? So it is one of the best deciding factors for a whole life carrier to allow for us to have good growth in the long term and know that we're working with a secure carrier.
So I think that's kind of a way to say that you're looking for strong companies. Like, the number one thing is you want a carrier that's going to be around for decades and centuries, because we're doing this for us, but also for the generations that are going to come after us. Now, we can always switch carriers down the road. The next generation doesn't have to use the same products, but certainly the products we get into right now have to last until we die. And a strong dividend paying company and one that has really good credit ratings is likely going to be around. So was that what you were saying? We're looking for a strong company.
So in generally, when we're talking whole life, we want a mutual company as well, because we are not sharing that dividend with shareholders. As mutual company policyholders, we are effectively owners in that company. And yes, we absolutely want it to be a strong company when we're assessing for whole life.
It's hard to just point out one thing, right? I would think right at the top, though, strong mutual company. You want a mutual company that has really, really good credit ratings, and it's been paying a dividend out above and beyond their guaranteed amount for well over a century. Like, the top carriers that we like to use have been paying out dividends for 150 plus years.
Yes. And I think one other factor with that strong company is they have large amounts of assets that are secure assets. And that's what helps them contribute to paying that strong dividend. So, I mean, overall, I think that's the most important thing. And my own whole life policy, it's actually not one of the better ones from the perspective of technology and online access. We're all used to this online banking and stuff like that. But I am super happy with the performance of the policy and the strength of the company. So I'm fine not having the ideal technology interface for my policy.
Yeah, it seems like companies that really focus on providing a good product that performs really well, they don't necessarily keep up to date on 21st century technology. Although I think eventually all the carriers are going to move to that space. It's just not a priority for some. So in the whole life space, I would also say that it's very important that we can do a specialized design in order to generate higher cash value. There's a lot of strong companies out there. They don't pay that much dividends out. And in addition to that, even if they do pay out a decent dividend, if we can't design the policy right, a company that pays out a similar or lower dividend that we can design specially to get that early strong cash value growth ends up with way more death benefit and way more cash value down the road than a similar company that we can't do that same type of design. Is that what you find?
Oh, absolutely. I think that is definitely one of the biggest considerations when we are looking at optimizing a policy. You have to have some kind of blend in these whole life policies for the optimal performance. Now, there's circumstances where you might not need that, but having a good option of a high ratio of what we can blend in with that base policy in order to minimize that commission, that's what lets us have strong cash value growth and strong early cash value. A properly designed whole life policy can see 80-90% cash value in that year one of premium. So that's on an optimized policy, optimally funded. That is a pretty strong performance or pretty strong ratio of what you have accessible in cash value. And that blend is absolutely imperative for that.
Yeah. And I've had some clients that have specifically said that they're not too concerned about paying a commission. They understand that people need to get paid. And my response to them is like, okay, great. Let me sell you a high commission policy. No, not really. I tell them, like, even though you've just told me that you don't mind paying a big commission, I'm still going to show you this design that minimizes the commission. It's not just about minimizing the commission and having access to more cash value, just to have more access to cash value. It gives these policies the greatest likelihood of success. It makes it easier to fund these policies at a high level when you can see the direct result of it turn the money you're adding in turning into cash value and the projected growth just doing so much better year after year than it otherwise would if we didn't do that blended design, because we're not just reducing the commission, but we're reducing quite a bit of the other expenses inside the policy, and it kind of all adds up.
Yes, and really, in that, when I mentioned that 80-90% year one cash value, well, if not properly designed, even with the best carriers, you can end up with zero cash value in year one for those poorly designed policies. If cash value is your goal, you want to make sure that you have an optimized policy. So it's not just the carrier and product that matters when it comes to that. And having that ability to do that blend is integral so that you have cash value early on.
Yeah, and it's funny because when we're looking at the products that we can really do the best with, ultimately, you're going to settle on a specific product. Once you get to a specific product, there's an optimal design for that product, right? So we can't really compare the different little bit of details between the different designs that you might do between one product and another. Those ones vary. In general, when we find the really strong products with the really strong carriers, then we go with the optimal design with that particular product. Now, let's point out maybe something that's a big red flag. Like, what's, you mentioned not having any cash value up front might be a big red flag, but what might be an immediate turnoff in a whole life product?
Yes. So I think one thing that really kind of will immediately want you to move away from a certain carrier would be, if they recently demutualized, that can be a bad thing. You don't want to go. I mean, we mentioned earlier that we want to see a mutual company, but that often means that they didn't do a great job managing their assets, managing their risk. And so seeing a company that demutualizes is a big red flag for me when it comes to a whole life carrier.
That's a good point. That's a really good point. Demutualization, I mean, it's probably already too late at that point for you to get a policy that's going to be very attractive. What happens when they demutualize is the current policy owners tend to only get the guaranteed rates from then on. So the guaranteed rates are not very good. Like, that's, you're going to probably get out of those products and run if that ends up being the situation. Now, before a demutualization, a lot of carriers out there are opting for becoming a mutual holding company instead of a full demutualization. This is like a hybrid where the mutual company ends up creating a stock company that they can sell shares in. That's kind of like a level below, and they block off the old book of business. And so they can still kind of operate as a mutual company, but the policy owners, your whole life policy owners, end up with like 51% voting in that. And there's shareholders that are going to get some voting rights in there. It's not the majority, but it's 49%. And a lot of people tend to think that a mutual holding company might just be a stepping stone on the way to an eventual demutualization. Like, there's the reason they tend to move into that and from an actual strong mutual company is because they're not quite so strong anymore. And they need access to other cash that they wouldn't otherwise get. And the only other option is demutualization.
Yeah, so that's the main thing. So we led off with, what do we look for? Strong companies. And one of the biggest red flags really comes down to companies that have indicators that they're losing strength. I think that is, in my mind, one of the biggest red flags for a given carrier.
Good points. The other thing I look for is, we really want some strong companies that have access to a lot of cash. They have a lot of reserves. There's a lot of carriers out there that might look good for doing infinite banking and be someplace that you might put a lot of your dollars. But I would be hesitant to have hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars with some of these carriers that maybe only manage less than $1 billion in cash. I mean, we basically don't need to do that because there's better options. You don't need to settle for a small carrier when there are plenty of very, very large carriers that, just from a general standpoint, you would feel more comfortable owning that company. That's what you're doing when you're buying a whole life policy. You're becoming an owner of that company, if it's with a mutual company, of course. Now, we want to be an owner of a really well-run whole life company. They're really good at managing business. They're really good at managing bonds. They know exactly how much money they're going to make probably for the next 20 to 30 years.
Yes, I think that really ties into what place does whole life sit in an asset portfolio? And in my asset portfolio, I think James's asset portfolio, whole life is intended to be one of the most secure assets, probably the most secure asset in our portfolio of assets, because we want to have those strong companies, from dividend paying companies that have paid dividends for 150 years or over 100 years. That's what this asset is. And if you go with a company that's smaller assets that they have as a company overall, then that means it's just not as secure of an asset as one that has a lot of different investments and bonds that in their overall portfolio is stronger. So that's just a really important factor when it comes to assessing a whole life company.
So let's wrap up the whole life space and we'll just summarize the main things we look for: good products for a whole life company, strong company financially and credit wise, a big bank balance or a big reserve balance. They're a mutual company. We can do a nice blend when it comes to designing the products that gives us a really strong early cash value, which translates into massive cash value down the road, really good internal rate of return. And then one thing we didn't discuss, I guess we'll probably be talking more about this next week, because next week we're going to be talking about which carriers and which actual products work best. So we're going to talk more specifics about that. But we didn't even get into direct recognition or non-direct recognition as far as the products. I don't generally have a preference between the two, as I think there's some good options in either space, although actually, that's not true. I think I do tend to lean toward the direct recognition side. How about you?
My own policy is a direct recognition policy. I do think that it's totally fine. I guess if, in the grand scheme of things, if I knew that I could get non-direct recognition with the strongest dividend history and all of that, maybe it would be great as well. But it's not really a deciding factor for me. When we consider those other variables, that's what comes into the deciding factor for a given policy. Some people might be very important. The loan structure for their whole life carrier might be very important for them. And, you know, that's where we have a discussion for folks. But it is not a big deciding factor for my own choice in the carrier, and generally not the first factor that I would recommend for folks to think about these things.
Yeah, that's a good way to phrase it. I find myself saying that to clients a lot. You might think that this is an interesting thing, but it's not a deciding factor. There is certain circumstances where people do need to be aware of the differences between non-direct and direct recognition loans. Case in point, there's a carrier out there right now. Their dividend rates are at 5.75%, and the loan rates are now up to 7%. That could be disastrous if you're somebody that has a massive amount of loans out and you were relying on the low dividend or the low interest rate environment that we were in the recent past, and maybe an increase in interest that high can screw up your plans. So that's definitely a factor. In a direct recognition policy, that just doesn't happen. The loan rates are fixed for most of the policy. Well, there's some that it's fixed for the length of the policy, and then there's other ones that it adjusts, but it's not going to adjust in relation to the amount of credit that you're getting when it comes to the direct recognition. So the direct recognition could be safer for a lot of people.
And it can result in a wash loan too. So that is a big consideration for some of these carriers, that you won't have such negative arbitrage that you just described of a lower dividend rate and a higher loan rate. That's a pretty big amount of negative arbitrage. Now, in a low interest rate environment, you could have an opportunity there with a non-direct recognition policy, but you do have some risks there when it is a higher interest rate environment. So I think it's just not a deciding factor of the loan structures when it comes to whole life, in my mind. Now, on the IUL side, I'll say that I do think about that a bit more, but for whole life, it's not as much of a concern.
All right, well, let's wrap it up with the whole life and move on to the IUL. We will engage more in this discussion next week when we dive into specific carriers and their products and which ones work best and why they work best. So, IULs, what do we look for in the IULs?
I think the first factor, similar to the whole life, is we want a strong company. Even though we're not necessarily owners in that company, we want a company that is strong, has a history of a good credit rating as a company, so that we know that this company is not going to go away. So generally speaking, similar to whole life, we want a strong company with a good amount of assets that they're managing.
That is probably the number one thing that we want to see. There's definitely more risks in the IUL space, but I don't look for a mutual company at all in this space, because if you own an IUL, it's not a whole life policy and you're not an owner of the company. So there's no advantage to being with a mutual company over a stock company or a mutual holding company in the IUL space. Zero advantage. In fact, there could be some extra advantages to not being in a mutual company in that scenario, just in the regard that, like, the mutual companies I'm familiar with don't sell the best IULs. So there's something there that it's just not their top product. It's not their priority. Mutual companies tend to do better in the whole life space, and I tend to see stock companies offer better products in the IUL space, or mutual holding companies offer better products in the IUL space.
Yeah, and it sort of ties to the factor of there is, when you compare whole life and IUL, there is more risk involved with an IUL, and you still want a strong company. It is a strong product that is relatively low risk, but it is a bit of a more of a risk transfer when you go from whole life to IUL. And that's why it's not, the mutual companies, as James mentioned, are not generally the strongest with IULs. They have really good whole life policies usually with those mutual companies.
Yeah. And in the IUL space, really, we do expect to own these products for decades, many, many, many decades. So it's important that we have a strong company there. The product itself allows us to design it at a very low expense, lets us dump in a whole bunch of money. So being able to do that blended design that we regularly talk about, I think it's even more important in the IUL space, because there's zero advantages to paying any extra expenses than you have to in the IUL space. We want to minimize those expenses as much as possible, because the less the expenses are, the more of your cash is going into your index options. And the growth of the index, the insurance company has no effect on what the index is going to do in any given year. So the S&P 500, they can adjust where the caps are at. But the S&P 500 is going to do what it's going to do. So if you're with a carrier that offers a good cap, a nice high cap, you're going to be able to participate in it if the index does well. So the strong companies with the nice designs that we can do give us a really good opportunity for growth in that scenario.
And I would say that's actually ties into what I would say is the next thing that we want to look at for an IUL carrier, or what are those index options that we have access to within that, whether that's some kind of proprietary index or the S&P options that we have for indexing strategies. We want to make sure that we have access to index options that will give us good credits in the long term. And there's various factors that we might consider. James mentioned the S&P. When we look at S&P indexing strategies, we want to make sure that the cap on that return for the S&P is going to be higher So that way we know that they're managing expenses and they're able to get a good return if somebody does choose the S&P, or if they are looking at a proprietary index, some of these uncapped options. We want to generally find a good uncapped option, and usually that's one of these proprietary index options that we might look at for some of these carriers as well.
Yeah, I agree. I think the reason we're buying these products is for the growth. So there's no reason to buy it if the insurance company is going to limit our potential growth with low caps and low participation rates. So among the top, I would say there's three main things that we look at in the IUL space: strong company, good index options, and the ability to do a blended design. We mentioned the blended design so much, but like as a case in point, there's a carrier out there, there's multiple that don't allow us to do a blended design. But one in particular, we can't do a blended design. They have decent index options, but they also have an account value charge that they add on as an extra fee. And so when we're doing a large dollar policy, let's say $1 million policy, that might pay out a $20,000 commission compared to a blended design that we can do that might pay out a $2,000 commission. That makes a massive difference in the amount of expenses that you're going to see in those policies. And the indexes, it's not like you're getting much. You really don't get anything extra as far as growth potential from that particular carrier compared to our preferred carriers. We get zero advantages by putting out those massive fees in order to pay the big commissions. And I just don't get it. Like, those products don't appeal to me at all.
Yes, I think that's why we've mentioned on both the whole life and the IUL side that blend is very important. I think, as we also mentioned, when it comes to IUL, it's even that much more important because it's really about minimizing those expenses and getting cash growth so that we can have eventually that cash growth has to outweigh the expenses in that policy such that we don't have the concept of reduced paid up in an IUL. We just need to get our cash growth to a point where it easily covers whatever minimal insurance expense we might have in old age.
Yeah, the Overland Protection Rider, there are certain circumstances where it might not be available. So we definitely want to make sure that that's available. Every carrier does offer it, but there are some designs of products that it's not included. So you do want to include that. So one of the biggest things, step back just a little bit, one of the things you said made me think about the expenses in these things. What I want to see in a product is the ability to reduce the insurance amount in the future to an amount that is very, very low. And ultimately, what we're looking for is potential expenses that are like 0.1, 0.2% of the overall cash value that we've grown in old age. That's the most important part. We don't want to be paying for a whole lot of insurance once this annual renewable term insurance that IUL is built on gets expensive. So we got to have the ability to make that as low as possible. And if you have a product that carries an asset value charge or an account value charge, where the bigger we grow that account, the bigger the expense that's going to be with it, that kind of offsets the whole purpose of minimizing the insurance cost in the future. Like, one of the big appeals to me is I might own this product at 85 years old that I've got millions of dollars in, and my expenses for them to manage that much money, giving me upside potential, downside protection every single year, and the expenses might be in the thousands of dollars. Like, that's very appealing, because when I'm 85 years old, I'm probably not managing my own money at that point. And I don't want to be paying a financial manager 1% to be managing that money. They can't offer me any downside protection, but the insurance company can. So if we can save up our money in a product like that and have such a minuscule amount of expenses, as well as the ability to tap into it tax-free, sign me up.
Connected to that, one of our favorite products has a 1% guarantee for some of its indexing strategies. So in the end, that 1% guarantee could be really completely offsetting and more than covering all of the insurance expense in a given policy. So that's, yes, it's not reduced paid up, but if there is the ability to have cash value growth such that that 1% more than covers that minimal insurance that you're paying for in old age, it's effectually the same thing.
100% agree. So I think the last thing to talk about in the IUL space with what products we like and what we look for is what kind of loan options do they give us? I know there's at least one carrier out there that I don't like their loan options at all. They had a product for a long time that you don't get a participating index loan. You only get a wash loan that doesn't actually wash. So it's a fixed loan. You pay 3% or 3 point, you could pay up to 3.9% and only get a credit of 1%. You could have loans in this product that cost you 2.9% at some point in the future. I'd never sold that product. I don't want that risk. And I don't want my clients to have that risk that they could end up in that situation. Not when we have better alternatives. Like, what is the best loan rates that you see out there that are possible for people to get in a really good product?
In my own IUL, I pay 5% for a participating index loan that allows for me to have that possibility of positive arbitrage in my own policy. And I think 5% is a pretty decent rate. If I don't want to take that loan structure, I do have the ability to pay to, really, I think it's a net, well, it's not a full wash loan in the first 10 years of the policy, but I might pay 2.9 for the loan and they'll credit me 2% if I want to have that fixed option with a little bit less risk involved. So I think that's a really good loan structure that is with a really great carrier.
And that's just the first 10 years. The wash loan doesn't actually wash. After that, guaranteed to wash. And the 5%, that's for the life of the policy. Like, I always think about the cash value in our life insurance, whether it's whole life or IUL. I look at that as a line of credit. How great is it going to be that you have access to a line of credit that will always be 5% interest for your entire life? It doesn't matter what else is happening in the world. Bank rates could skyrocket. Maybe loan rates go up to 10 and 12% again or higher, but we got access to cash at 5% and it doesn't interrupt the growth. Like, that's pretty special. There are some other carriers out there that might start out less than 5% where it's a variable rate, but they cap at 5%. That's not the norm though. And a lot of carriers, they'll have a variable rate that they could raise it up to 8%. I guess at the end of the day, what I look for is stability in the loan options. I want to know, what can I expect from these loans far into the future? Because like I keep saying, we're going to own these products for decades. I want that to be the same product 30 years from now that it is today. I don't want the ability for it to change drastically. And there are some products out there that can change pretty drastically.
Yes, I think that, you know, with both whole life and IUL, one of the great things is these are assets that we are building wealth in for decades. That's the goal with these products. And by virtue of not losing access to the funds, especially in my own circumstances, my IUL is what I tap first, knowing that I have that opportunity for positive arbitrage. I experienced that this past year in my own policy, having some positive arbitrage, effectively earning money on borrowed funds. It's a crazy thing that is something that we can do with these policies. And I think that's what really drew me to implementing these strategies and using life insurance as our line of credit.
I think that was a good discussion with all this. Let's wrap it up for this week. We're going to be back next week talking about which carriers and products work best for the high cash value life insurance design. For a call to action this week,
it's time for this week's call to action.
I think I would point people to listen back to this podcast and try to identify what might be the top things that you would look for. What makes you the most comfortable as far as being able to put a large percentage of your money, potentially, of cash into a product? Like, where are you going to be comfortable storing a lot of money? As with any investment, a certain amount is too much if you can't sleep at night because you get too nervous at what it's going to do. There's certain safety in life insurance products, high cash value, whole life, and IUL. There's a lot of safety in it. But what are the top things that you would look for? And maybe reach out and have a discussion with one of us. See what our thoughts are. Maybe there's something that matches what you're looking for.
And I would add, you know, when you look at your own circumstances, assess how much of your portfolio is at risk. Right now, we are in some interesting times, some volatility happening in various things, some speculation around various types of markets, whether that's real estate or stock markets, what might happen. Now is the time that you might want to get into an asset that is protected from market losses. So just another thing to think about, assessing your situation and maybe following up with a conversation with one of us to see how this could fit and serve that need in your own asset portfolio.
Good points. I do tend to see a spike in interest in life insurance products when the market is dropping. So we appreciate you guys joining us this week. With that, we're going to end it. My name is James Barber. I'm your Oregon Cash Flow Pro. You can find me on YouTube at Oregon Cash Flow Pro. I'm licensed across the country for life insurance and annuities.
And my name is Carlo Vaquera with NetWealth Finance. You can find me at netwealthfinance.com or on YouTube at NetWealth Finance. And we'll work with clients across the country as well.
See you guys next week.
Thanks for watching.